spent a lot of time going through the narrative, but I'm assuming a lot of you have heard most of it by now. So I thought the best way to approach this would be to answer questions. Find out what you guys don't know and go from there.
So I was struck by the fact that you decided to ask the government to pay for your time to develop a system to get them what they wanted. Because it seemed to me that they would never say yes to that, just because of the discretion that U.S. attorneys have or don't have to prove out of the ordinary kinds of things. And that if you really wanted that to happen, you could have said, well, I'd like you guys to pay for it, and I understand you can't agree to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's going to take me this much time, and I'm just going to go and do it and eat the loss. And I don't know if it was it part of your litigation strategy to ask them to do that, knowing they would not say yes, or, you know, why did you...
I was actually afraid they would say yes. And I was afraid they would say yes because it would set a precedent that I could be forced to modify my system. And if I could modify my system to collect meta information, I could modify my system to collect passwords and content as well. And I didn't want to set that legal precedent. But as it turns out, they turned me down because I wouldn't be turning the information over to them in real time. Go figure. It was not a, that was one of the two excuses, but the primary one was the real time. And the fact was, I didn't have the code. I didn't have a config switch I could turn on and all of a sudden collect this information. I figured over the course of its entire lifetime, it'd take about 20 hours worth of work to write the code, deploy it to 12 different servers, monitor to ensure that it's actually functioning the way it is, and then remove it at the end. And they said, well, that's too much money. Okay, you're the federal government, you can't afford $2,000? Sure. Maybe you don't want this information as badly as you sound. Because the value of the SSL keys that I turned over was around $2,000 as well. It's kind of an interesting thing. And they would have had to pay for the cost of replacing those. So they kind of dropped the whole... No, they would have... It says it in the statute. Reasonable expenses, something like that. And apparently they've done that in the past. I found that little tidbit of information out, which is how one of the ways I know that they've done this before, even though I couldn't find any record of that, you know, on the public record. But yeah, no, it was an interesting little situation. And of course I said, well, you got to pay me up front because all that work I did for you back in 2010, you still haven't paid me for. And, you know, well, your credit rating isn't all that great right now. But I think that is why they ended up dropping the cost issue and focusing more on the real-time issue. It's kind of one of those things you see straight out of a movie. They wanted the suspect to log in and have it pop up on some big board in the command center that would say so-and-so is logging in from such-and-such location. We should go pick him up. It's the only thing I could think of. But that was their excuse in the end. They dropped the cost issue.
Real-time was a deal-breaker for you?
No. Real-time was a deal-breaker for me if I couldn't ensure that whatever device they were using was only collecting the information they were authorized to collect. We also discussed them turning over the hardware and software to me, configuring it with their assistance, and I broached, well, I hold 10 characters of the password, and you hold 10 characters of the password, and we know that neither of us happens to be logging into this device and using it inappropriately. And that was a deal breaker, too. Apparently, my security clearance wasn't high enough for that. Any other questions? Yeah.
You said you were not allowed to even speak about it, so why are you talking right now? Because you were not allowed?
Very good question. The way these statutes are written, when you're issued a pen trap and trace order, you're actually legally not allowed to even publicly disclose the existence of the order. If you refer to the language on my website, it said I'm appealing some magical little thing in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, that before everything was unsealed, I always referred to it as my legal fight. Apparently the word case was one of those words that could have gotten me in trouble because I can't admit I have a case. The only thing that the statute allowed was for me to discuss it with an attorney, and apparently that had to be litigated, you know, before I came along. Since I'm sure many of you are also curious, I'll talk about FISA warrants because there's a different protocol for them. They're not only sealed, but classified. So you're allowed to discuss them with your attorney, but only if your attorney has an active security clearance that you verified with the FBI. And apparently it takes them 12 weeks to do this. Kind of interesting, right? The other thing about classified warrants is that when you appeal them, they are appealed to a classified court, so they don't necessarily need to declassify anything, aka release it to the public, in order for that appeal to take place. Apparently, the only reason I can present any of the details to you here today is because when I appealed it, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals basically demanded that the lower court unseal all of the relevant details of my case in order for my appeal to progress in the public eye. If it weren't for that, I probably wouldn't be able to discuss any of the details with you here today. It just also goes to illustrate why we don't know about anything that's going on. You know, if there hadn't been some, they hadn't basically been trying to break into my network, and I wasn't as big of a, can't come up with another word, so I apologize, asshole, we still wouldn't know what was going on. And that's just kind of unfortunate. That it takes as much effort as it does for me to be able to just tell you what's going on.
Do you mind if I say a brief thing?
Is your name Richard?
Yes, it is.
Stallman?
Yes, it is.
I thought you looked familiar.
For listeners, Richard Stallman is the iconic MIT-based free software activist, inventor of the copyleft, and author of the GNU operating system, usually associated with Linux.
Would you like to come up and use the podium?
Oh, well, I wasn't going to ask for that much, but...
I figured I am in Boston. Go ahead.
And by chance, I'm here too, which isn't usually the case. Three cheers for Edward Snowden. Hip, hip, hurrah! Hip, hip, hurrah! Hip, hip, hurrah! Less important, I wrote an article recently about how the level of surveillance we have in this country, which is far more than there was in the USSR, is incompatible with democracy, and that when data is collected, it will be misused. The only way we can make democracy safe is by reducing the level of accumulation of data about everyone to the point where it's not enough to let the government reliably find whistleblowers such as our hero Edward Snowden. So we have to redesign systems. For more information, look at the article. It's gnu.org/philosophy/surveillance-vs-democracy.html with dashes between the words. And I won't take up any more time than what's not my talk.
What was your question?
You're a hero too. Don't call yourself an asshole.
I always blush when I hear the H word.
Can you write that on the board later?
I'll write it on the board now.
Did you have a question, though, when you raised your hand, or did you just want to make the statement?
I wanted to ask you if you thought of fleeing to another country to talk about what had happened.
I thought about it. But I didn't feel like I should have to flee to another country. It's kind of interesting. I had to basically draw upon everything I had learned with my political science degree. I basically had to draw upon everything I had learned in my political science courses and my mock debates in high school just to be able to fight this without getting arrested. And I actually have to accuse a couple of friends of mine, one of whom happens to be a professor just south of here in Manhattan, for teaching me in high school how to basically disagree with the government and express your disagreement without doing anything that allows you to be arrested. You know, one of those other great quotes that I can give you, it came from that same conversation with the lead prosecutor after I appeared, was, "You're lucky you haven't been arrested. A number of my colleagues thought we should." I kind of let slide the whole, well, what law did I break? Because apparently it's against the law to disagree with the government these days. So that was kind of what I took away from it. But I think in reality, it had to do more with the fact that if they had arrested me, my system would have shut down. There wouldn't have been anybody left to maintain it. I had other employees who had access, but they didn't have access to everything. Kind of that whole least privileges thing. Coupled with the fact that after I did shut down, I kind of drew enough media attention that they probably became pretty clear that the only thing they would do by arresting me would be give me a bigger soapbox. That, if I had been arrested, I don't know how many of you in here know what Star Chamber is. Wow, I am at Harvard. Usually I don't see any hands. But basically, they could have arrested me. I wouldn't have been able to tell anybody why I had been arrested because those same secrecy provisions would have stayed in place. And they could have held me in contempt, criminal contempt, for up to 12 days. And then I'm apparently entitled to a public trial because of Star Chamber. It's still a little unclear what I would have been able to legally say at my own trial, though. So I was really put in a pretty difficult position. The point I'm trying to make is that I really didn't have a choice, at least with my own personal ethical beliefs. You know, in the state of Texas, we have data breach laws. I'm actually required by law in Texas to disclose the very kind of breach that was taking place. And when I brought that up, he said, well, you don't have to worry about it. Federal law trumps state law. I was, yeah, but it doesn't trump the ethical obligation. It was really, that's what it came down to. I didn't want to be administering a system that was handing all of the data over to the feds. That wasn't what I built LavaBit for. And if that was the case, it was very easy for me to decide to shut down once I weighed all of the factors that I talked about earlier. You had a question up over here.
How do you know that the government doesn't already have your SSL codes and it's just pretending they don't?
It's actually a very good question, and it's one I've wondered myself. And the answer is you don't. And I'll tell you why I say that. Why would they come and ask for them again if they already had them? Well, there's this little rule that prevents them from using illegally obtained evidence in a criminal trial. So if they really wanted to use any of the information that they were attempting to gain at some future criminal trial, they would have had to prove how they obtained it and ensure everyone at the trial that it was obtained legally. So that's why they came after me for the keys. They may have been collecting the information already. I don't know. May also be that I was such a cheap bastard and bought such old equipment off eBay that I didn't have any of the fancy new surveillance vulnerabilities introduced in the hardware. There's been a lot of talk lately about whether or not the random number generators and Intel chips can be trusted. In fact, I've heard from a couple of people that when Snowden arrived in Russia, the KGB tossed out all their computers and switched back to using typewriters. So that's the real problem, is I don't know.
Would it change your behavior?
If what?
If they already did have your keys. I mean, surely you should resist.
Yeah, I would have resisted just the same because, first of all, how would I have known that they had the keys unless they showed them to me? And if they showed them to me, then I would have just said, well, why the heck don't you just go use them? Why are you putting me through this whole process? In fact, something to that effect did happen. There was a meeting June 28th, and it was the meeting where the two FBI agents showed up at my door as I was getting ready to head out and enjoy my Friday evening. And over the course of what was a 2 to 3 hour conversation, the issue of SSL came up, and they said, well, you'll have to turn over your SSL keys. And I was like, oh, I think I better consult with a lawyer before I do that. But we went on to discuss the fact that, well, yeah, that would allow you access to all of the content, but you still wouldn't be able to get access to any of the content that was stored on disk. And I said, well, we'll just collect the password and turn it over to you. And I thought that was very curious, and I asked him, why don't you just log in yourself? He didn't really have a good answer for it, but does anybody know the real answer for that?
Barred by statute.
Exactly. Even if they have your password, they can't log in as you. Kind of goes back to that same SSL key question. You know, there are all these laws and statutes, and I don't understand every single one of them well enough. But I think even if they did have access already, that ultimately the reason they had to demand the keys was because they needed to be able to prove how they got the data in court. There's another thing that's very important to realize in this whole debate. They were only authorized to collect meta information. That's to, from, date and time, login date and time, logout date and time, and originating IP, at least in the email world. How much of that information could they have gotten without the SSL keys? Anybody know the answer? I'm sure Richard does. No? All of it except the login stuff. That's because mail protocols generally do not use SSL server to server, service provider to service provider. This is a guesstimate, but I think about 80% of all messages travel the internet from one provider to another without SSL. So as soon as they put the tap in place, that means they're probably getting that meta information off about 80% of those emails. And because my system, while it did not record the IP address that somebody logged in from, it did record the IP address that they used when they transmitted an outbound message in the headers of the message. They probably could have gotten that originating IP address for that login data at least whenever the user sent a message. So really what they came after me for, really what they were demanding my keys for, was so they could figure out the date and time of the login. It was really hard to believe that they would go through everything they did just to find out when the user was logging in and logging out. They like to claim that you just need to trust us, that we're only going to collect what we're authorized to collect, but it became very hard to do that once you know that. Once you know there's this only tiny piece of information that they can't get already, they're not admitting that to the court. Apparently the device was wholly ineffective until they got their SSL keys. That's what they said in their court filings. So I just had to assume the worst. I love the prosecutor. He went on in that same discussion. There were a couple of great discussions in this whole debacle. The June 28th meeting in my apartment, and then, of course, directly after I appeared on my own behalf in court. And this lead prosecutor went on to say, well, if anyone, any agent of the federal government violated the law and went beyond and collected information that they weren't authorized to collect, they'd lose their badge and go to jail. Well, about, 2.5 weeks later, 3 weeks later, I shut down, and about a week and a half after that, that Washington Post article came out, and we learned a new term, loveint. And it talked about the 2,786 violations that the NSA had been reported, just reported, not ones that we didn't know about, just in the previous year, of instances where NSA analysts had gone beyond the mandate that they were operating under. And that completely ignores this whole problem of, well, they could just go to this FISA court and get this secret order that makes it legal for them to collect everything anyways. And that was also one of the big problems I had. I just didn't trust them. You know, we have this saying in the computer world, trust but verify.
Probably.
I didn't know he was the first one. I can attribute it to a computer science professor.
Reagan didn't invent the Russian force. Reagan attributed it to a Russian force.
I'm finding that as I learn, memorize more and more quotes, that usually you can go back about three levels. There's the person you think it was attributed to, then there's the person you think they attributed to, and so on and so forth. It's like that saying, there's no such thing as a new idea, we just borrow.
You mentioned that one of the appeals courts unsealed your previous documents, all of these other cases.
Technically not. The district court that originally denied my two motions to unseal later on reversed its position as the result of a ex parte government filing, and we think that they did that because of the appeals court.
So did you, throughout your legal dealings, did you find that at least with the judges there was actually a discourse going on about whether or not the laws were being properly applied? Or, because when you speak mostly from the point of prosecutors where it seems very one-sided. But...
Yeah, I don't think so, because it would have been illegal. You know, the same restrictions on speech applied to their side as they did to my side.
So were the proceedings fair?
I guess that depends on your point of view. But yeah, no, one of the interesting things I heard is that at least while the case was sealed, I didn't have to worry about the contempt charge fine because it would have been illegal for them to reduce it to judgment because that would have been violating their whole, you know, protections against speech. So there's a double-edged sword. One of the problems with having it unsealed is now I get a really big bill.
I'm not sure if you can answer this question, but how much of what actually happened can you tell us right now? Like...
I can tell you all of the important stuff related to the SSL key demand. I can't talk about any other investigation. I can't talk about anything that may or may not have happened after that demand. I also can't talk about anything that may or may not have happened in the FISA court.
Can you say a bit about, in retrospect, given how laws were have been interpreted, whether or not...
I love this definition of data that apparently, what is it, Clapper has come up with. Apparently, metadata is not data, even though metadata includes the word data. And that apparently this definition was developed by the NSA lawyers, and they just neglected to tell anybody else on the planet that that's how they... thought. It's like that whole, the truth and nothing but the truth, the whole truth. Well, if you're going to have some messed up interpretation of a word that nobody else on the planet shares, shouldn't you at least say that? Anyway, sorry, I interrupted.
So taking all this interpretation as a given, in retrospect, are there things that you would have done differently in the design of the technical architecture for Lavabit and the system architecture and the way cryptography was used? And again, taking the way that law enforcement and courts are interpreting the law, are there things that we would want in email privacy that seem unachievable given just technical solutions and really fundamentally needed?
Well, there are a bunch of issues there. It's a complicated question. Hope I remember to address everything. By the way, I also can't tell you who was under investigation. He who shall not be named. But to answer your question, I've been thinking about the problems with email security for a long time. I mean, I wrote a mail daemon. I implemented network protocols. I knew exactly what was being sent over the wire. And for years, I'd been kind of thinking, well, maybe what we need to do is integrate something like PGP into SMTP as an extension. So this whole key lookup process can happen automatically, and you know, everybody can use PGP. I just figured if I did it, nobody would notice, and nobody would care, because I was, again, a small business. The other problem was, if I had done that, I would have had to deal with the whole client side of the equation. Part of the reason I addressed the problem the way I did is because I could do it within the confines of what was possible, given the current mail protocols. I wanted it to be easy to use. I understood its deficiencies. I am somewhat of a computer security guy. But I didn't think I could address the entire problem, so I tried to address a small subset of the problem. And that was your provider having all of your private information sitting on your server. You know, I couldn't do anything about the data before it arrived, and I couldn't do anything about it after it arrived at your computer. But I thought by developing this system that relied on server-based encryption, somebody could use it without any additional software or knowledge, and it would at least prevent me from being forced to violate their privacy. At least that was the goal. Now, if I had known that they were going around demanding SSL keys, what could I have done? Well, there's this interesting debate over Diffie-Hellman. And that's this extension to SSL that basically provides for perfect forward secrecy that most providers don't have enabled because it introduces about 150 milliseconds of additional delay every time you make a connection to their servers. I know I supported Diffie-Hellman, but I actually thought, based on how the government was acting, that I wasn't configuring my servers to prefer it, so therefore it wasn't being used. Turns out I was wrong. Turns out that Firefox, Opera, and Chrome were all were using cipher suites that provided for perfect forward secrecy. I still can't tell you which mail clients would have selected a cipher that includes perfect forward secrecy, but I have to assume it's roughly an equivalent percentage, which means even if I turned over those keys, if they were in fact doing a third-party observer attack, they would only get about 30% of the data, which is interesting because if we go back to what they were going to get plus what they were authorized to do, you're talking about a very small subset of information they're allowed to look at, an even smaller subset that they're allowed to collect. Unfortunately, my case doesn't deal with the issue of a man in the middle. That'll have to wait, but it also means that if I lose and I set a bad precedent, the next person will get to litigate the man in the middle issue because it'll almost certainly be required. The only positive change that I can say I've seen so far is the fact that more and more providers are emphasizing cipher suites that provide for perfect forward secrecy. In the news just last week, Twitter announced that they had done it. And they had to go through a lot of steps to support it because of how complex their network was. And the fact that they wanted to use session tickets for session resumption and so forth. It's all very interesting, but I don't want to put anybody to sleep. How could I have addressed the SSL issue? Because that's a hard one. My servers need access to these SSL keys in order to support SSL. So how does a server have a key without being able to access it? The only solution that I've been able to come up with is the use of what's called a hardware security module. It's basically this PCI card that I would stick in each server. I could load the key onto that PCI card, and then the computer could use that card for the RSA operations without ever having direct access to the key. Once I load the key on the card, I blow away the password, and I have a functioning system that I no longer have access to. There are a couple of problems with that, though. One, those cards cost $5,000 a piece. I was buying $300 servers off eBay. The math just doesn't work very well. The other problem is there's nothing to say that if I told the FBI that I couldn't access the key, they wouldn't come along and say, well, you just have to get new keys and start using those instead of the ones you have loaded on these HSMs. So I could have invested a whole bunch of money on PCI cards that in the end wouldn't have done anything. I think ultimately the only way we're going to win this war is in the courts. And I think it's a war that can be won because this is data that belonged to my business. It didn't belong or was generated by any user. This was a LavaBit trade secret. And at the very least, I think these keys shouldn't be turned over based on the current writing of the law, the current statutes. Now, I just have to hope the appeals court, or at the very least, the Supreme Court, agrees with me.
In the district court, when did you shift from being unrepresented to having counsel, and to what extent do you think that affected the way it worked out for you in the district court?
Didn't affect one thing one bit.
Or maybe it'll affect the appeals court.
It may affect the appeals court, but at the appellate level, I have certainly a lot more resources, and I have to thank everyone here for that, or at least anyone who donated to the LavaBit Legal Defense Fund. Because I didn't have enough money to afford the legal counsel that I would need to properly adjudicate this. I was a small business. I didn't have $100,000 sitting in a bank account just in case I got sued or just in case the FBI decided to come along and demand my keys. I did contact the EFF. I found out later on that part of the reason they referred me to a former staff attorney is because they felt they would have had a conflict of interest if they took this case. I reached out to the federal public defender, who was also conflicted out, and there was a third law firm that said they were conflicted out. But the primary problem I ran into is that all the lawyers I could afford were criminal defense attorneys. What's the primary objective in most cases for a criminal defense attorney? Anyone? Keep you out of jail. I was actually less concerned about going to jail than I was about turning over the keys. And these criminal defense attorneys that I was talking to leading up to my hearing didn't seem to get that. That the real issue was whether or not I had to turn over these keys, and if I had to go to jail to prove that for a few days, I was willing to do that. I was lucky. The only person that depended upon me had four legs and a tail. So once I provided for her, the thought of spending a couple of days defending the Constitution by getting locked up really didn't bother me. In fact, I was more bothered by the fact that they came and asked for $10,000 than I was by the fact that they didn't arrest me. My lawyer was nice enough to tell them that. But no, just going further, I wasn't able in the 3 days I was afforded to be able to find an attorney that I could both afford and who understood the issues. The person who I ended up retaining, Jesse Benal, I ended up speaking to him maybe an hour or two before I had to appear. And basically what we decided is, hey, if you manage to get a continuance, give me a call, we'll work something out. And while he didn't understand the technology or the area of law, he at least understood that there was more at stake than my own liberty. But, I mean, he still only had a week to prepare that motion to quash. And this was not his area of specialty. His law firm at the time was like 9 people, and he still charged me like $5,000, I think. So he didn't exactly have the resources to go up against a government that, at least on the appeal reply, had 9 signatories. I mean, when I walked into the courtroom and I was representing myself that first time, there were at least 6 or 7 people on the other side of the aisle. Five. And that's only because, like I said, I was able to raise money. At the previous level, it was 1 versus, 5 or 6. So it was kind of a lopsided battle, which is why I don't think, and given the fact that it was a former FISA judge that seemed, as my lawyer said, not to be buying anything we were selling. I think it would have, maybe if I had gotten a real hotshot attorney and a big law firm, maybe it would have been different. But those aren't certainly things I could have afforded. And that's a big part of the reason I took offense at the fact that I couldn't tell anybody about it. Because my first reaction was actually to post something to the OpenSSL mailing list and say, hey, this is going on. Does anybody know an attorney that's dealt with this issue before? And to also post some messages to a couple of legal mailing lists that deal with information privacy law and internet law and see if anybody who was specialized in this area would be willing to represent me pro bono. But I couldn't, because doing that would be illegal. So I had to call everybody one by one, and it's not like I had a Rolodex filled with lawyers 1,000 miles away in Alexandria that dealt with this particular area of law. In fact, the only one that I found wanted $500 an hour. And I couldn't afford that.
It does, thank you.
Either one.
So what do you think that big companies should do? Like, for example, Google, they can't exactly shut down Gmail.
Yeah, no, and I don't think they should. I know there's that famous Snowden reply where he comes out in support of my decision and asks why big companies don't fight the same way that Lavabit does. And yes, I would certainly like to see them shut down Gmail for a day. But the simple fact is, if I wasn't the sole owner of Lavabit, if I hadn't decided to build my business the hard way, I wouldn't have been able to make that decision. In fact, the last time I was on this campus was about 9 years ago, and it was for a startup school. And I had written a business plan and thought about raising venture capital, but after sitting through a day's worth of lectures, I decided I didn't want to. And I didn't want to because I felt that if I took in outside money, I wouldn't be able to protect Lavabit in the future and ensure that it always adhered to the philosophical principles in which it was founded. And that was kind of the situation I was facing. Now, what should Google do? That's really hard for me to say because so much of what they're fighting for happens to be in a secret court. Now, when I started my little battle, I went around and asked some people that I knew would know more than I did, had security clearances and would have a better understanding, and I learned a few things, that most of which has been revealed by the media in the ensuing months, but I knew that Google's network was tapped. I thought it was legally. I didn't think it was without their knowledge. But they're really faced with a difficult situation. I said it earlier today, but you know, I think I'm a pretty good network administrator. I'm pretty good when it comes to information security, but I certainly wouldn't want the task of trying to defend my network from the NSA for all of eternity. Because unfortunately, software bugs exist, vulnerabilities exist, and unfortunately, they find them before most of the public. And it would be very difficult for me to ensure that my network remains secure indefinitely. So what should they be doing beyond what they're already doing? Well, they're doing everything they can legally. I mean, the only thing else they could really do would be take some of the documents that they're aware of that they're not allowed to release publicly and get them released and break the law. And it's kind of hard to tell somebody, well, you should break the law and go to jail. Beyond that, I'm not too sure.
What email provider should I use today?
Well, I can't vouch for any other provider because, like I said, I heard that most, the way it was described to me by somebody who had a TS clearance and basically specialized in cryptography was all the other providers have been tapped. They're seeing you as a gap in their surveillance network. And I was like, well, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. So with that knowledge, it was hard for me to come out and say you should use somebody else. What you need to understand is that email is inherently secure and it doesn't really matter what provider you use. If you're not using something like PGP, you don't really have too many choices. But that's also why I paired up with Phil Zimmerman and John Callis, and we're hoping to create a new set of protocols and a new suite of server and client software that will make end-to-end encryption, like you get with PGP, ubiquitous. Easy enough for grandma to use is what I like to say. And that's sort of the goal, because I think until we get to that point, you can't really trust email. Now, whether or not you have to trust email is kind of a personal choice. I saw a bunch of other hands there.
I'm curious about the device that they attach the device to your server.
I am too, by the way.
What was the process by which they approach you and attach something?
Well, this is kind of how the conversation went. So, how big is the device? Oh, you don't need to worry about that. How much power does it use? You don't need to worry about that. But I'm close to my power limit. Oh, you don't need to worry about that. How much bandwidth will it use? You don't need to worry about that. Just give us your SSL keys. I'm like, well, can I at least go look up online? You know, can you tell me who made the device so I can find out what its capabilities are? Is it one of these devices that can only do a few things? I'm like, we don't even know the answer to that. And I think it was one of these situations where that device itself was, in fact, classified. And therefore, its capabilities were classified, so they couldn't really tell me anything, even if they did know, and I'm not 100% sure they did, which made it even harder for me to trust them. You know, they just wanted my keys. And in fact, in the end, I didn't even have to provide them access to my network. They just installed the tap upstream, which means they served my provider with an order that I can't see. So I don't know when it was installed. I don't know what information it was authorized to collect. I can't see it. It still hasn't been unsealed. Richard?
You know, I had a question a few minutes ago, and I'm so sleepy.
You know what it is? Programmers, we use our short-term memory so much when we're programming that it's like a repetitive stress injury. I don't know how many times I've found myself standing in the bathroom and completely forgotten why I got up and went to the bathroom. And it wasn't to go to the bathroom.
I just want to consider your argument against the, like, the usual remark that if your clients don't have anything to hide, then
I love that. If you don't have anything to hide, then what's the problem? Well, you might not have anything that you're doing that's illegal, but that doesn't mean you don't have anything that you've said to a loved one that would be a little bit embarrassing if it ended up on the 5 o'clock news. And that's the problem, is that this information that they're collecting could be used against their political enemies. We don't have to look too far into our own history to find a director of the FBI who was willing and able to abuse the authority he was entrusted with for political gain, and namely, in that case, to ensure greater and greater funding for the FBI.
So I remembered my question, or my point was that there is something that Google could be doing. Google could be organizing people politically.
Which to do what?
Not to, to demand whatever change it might be.
And I think they are doing that. The problem is they can't tell us what we should be demanding because they can't tell us what they're fighting.
They don't have to tell us. Snowden already told us. They don't have to tell us anything more about what's wrong to get people organized to fight it. They could be lobbying the same way that the surveillance industry is lobbying and the military-industrial complex is lobbying. By the way, I can't remember the other point.
I was using GNU Linux. That's what you were going to ask.
Oh. I'm glad that, no, I was going to ask a more relevant point. I can't remember it now.
Google is lobbying. They've just joined ALEC, if you know what ALEC is.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's lobbying for repression. And
right. But that's what Google is doing right now. They're doing other things. Have you had any contact with Glenn Greenwald, R.C. Wheeler? Who are the people who have...
I have not spoken to Glenn Greenwald.
Is there a movement now?
I certainly know more people now that are in the middle of this fight than I did 3 months ago. 3 months ago, I was working way in almost anonymity. Like I said, I spent most of my time talking to my computer and my dog, and I think my computer was my best friend and made my dog jealous. Since then, I've obviously met a lot of people because I've spent most of the last 3 months on the road. I have met Laura Poitras. I ran into her in Brussels. I have not met Glenn Greenwald, but I have spoken to a couple of reporters at The Guardian, reporters based out of their New York office. So, I mean, we're all kind of in this fight together, so to speak. I think what's been really interesting is, you know, I've obviously been following what comes out in the paper particularly closely. I think I would have done that even if I hadn't been in the middle of it. I think it's interesting that I am in the middle of it because I certainly wasn't expecting to be. But the fact is that, you know, we see a major headline in the paper, and then the next day it's gone. The issue gets buried to the back page, and it's another week before it ends up on the tip of our tongues. And that's been a really interesting thing to follow, because I don't know why. And I guess I can relay a couple more anecdotes. I don't know how many of you know this, but President Obama was a civil rights attorney. And when he was a senator, a junior senator from Chicago, he spoke out vehemently against unsupervised mass government surveillance. And I think if there's one thing that he's been very skillful at doing, it's distracting the public from this debate. He likes to use phrases that make us sleep better at night, like appropriate safeguards and independent oversight. And I think as a result of his sort of spin and handling of this crisis, if you will, crisis on his side, I guess, a political crisis, it keeps disappearing from the public debate. I'm a big fan, as a result of what I've been going through, of the movie Wag the Dog. I'll also quote Phil Zimmerman, because I think he told me something that I hadn't realized, and I want to attribute my source on this, is that he doesn't think Obama was strong enough to stand up to a classified briefing. That even though he objected to most of this before he became president, that when he was sitting in a room full of five-star generals wearing all their pins and all their ribbons, and they were all unanimously saying, we need these to protect our country, he was unable and unwilling to stand up in front of that room and say, no, it's wrong.
Justice, see, chief executive officer. He's not an independent person.
True, but he could shut down all these programs. He has that authority. Apparently, he also has the authority to invade Syria, even if Congress says no, but that's another story.
You've sort of wandered through a lot of nuances of sort of email protocol technology and have sort of raised questions about what did the government think they were doing because they could have gotten most of the stuff they wanted and what they would have gotten was so trivial. Do you think the people you were dealing with actually understood the technology, or were they just, you know, sort of functionaries? Oh, you know, this is the cookie-cutter list of how we install this unnamed box that you have to worry about on a network?
It's an excellent question. I think my lawyers barely understood it, and only after long explanations by myself, many of which didn't take place until after our initial filing, which is why our appellate brief is, at least in my opinion, significantly better than our motion to quash. But I think what you're getting at is more of the important issue, which is I don't think the Department of Justice lawyers that were litigating the issue had any clue what they were litigating. I think it was strictly a situation where the FBI agent in charge of the investigation went to DOJ and said, I need this information. Would you go get it for us? And that's sort of how everything progressed. And I don't think the DOJ had any clue about what the technology was. They didn't understand how important SSL keys were to trust on the internet. I didn't think they understood what they were doing in terms of going against precedent. They just looked at it as, well, here's a provider that should want to help the government. Why isn't he? And tried to come up with some legal ninja mumbo jumbo to justify it. And their mumbo jumbo is basically that installation means not only installation, but anything in your power to make the device effective. And like I said earlier, I don't think as a provider, I had any obligation to make their device effective. It's also interesting, too, because I know of at least one occasion when I was in the room and I was dancing around the issue of basically saying I would rather litigate the issue of the SSL keys in a district court than the FISA court. But I was saying something along the lines of some other court. And it was the FBI agent who piped in and pointed out that there was another issue. And it was at that point that I realized that the DOJ lawyers had no clue. And basically the way I've come to understand it since then is that the FBI has really become a slave to two masters. On the one hand, they serve the DOJ in conducting domestic law enforcement investigations. And on the other, they cooperate with the NSA and the FISA court by interfacing with domestic companies in these foreign surveillance operations. And as a result, they've sort of been forced to play two roles. It's kind of a worst-case scenario. And it's why those two organizations were kept so separate before 9/11. Now, whether or not I think it should change and how I think it should change is really a more complex question than I think I'm qualified to answer. I just know that what they did in this case was certainly wrong.
So you mentioned earlier the fact that, like, there are some ongoing things. Can you talk about, like, any of, like, the ongoing stuff and sort of what the next steps are in the litigation process?
Well, almost immediately after I shut down, we filed a notice of appeal. That appeal was filed around October 10th. Amicus briefs, which were filed by the ACLU, EFF, and M People, were due October 24th. The government's reply to our appeal was due, about November 10th. And our reply to their reply was due 10 days afterwards, which was last Friday, so you can do the math. So now all the briefs have been filed, and we're just waiting to find out if we're going to be heard in court, because it's no guarantee that just because we filed a great appeal that they're actually going to schedule us for oral arguments. But we have been told that in all likelihood the case will be heard in the January 27th through 31st session of the 4th District Court of Appeals. So at this point, we're sitting and waiting for that process. And it's kind of funny. I actually thought an appeal would look something like it does on television. Found out I was wrong. Apparently, the two lawyers get up in front of a lectern and speak individually. There's no questioning. There's no new evidence. It really looks a lot more like the movie The People versus Larry Flint and the scene in which he's arguing for the First Amendment in front of the Supreme Court. Now, if we lose at the 4th District Court of Appeals, we'll obviously appeal it to the Supreme Court. If we win, we'll be in an interesting situation because we'll set a precedent in the 4th Circuit, but that will only be binding in the 4th Circuit. At that point, be up to the federal government to see if they want to appeal it to the Supreme Court, because only a decision by the Supreme Court would set a precedent for the entire country. So that's kind of where we're at. There's also this tricky issue of waivers, where the government says, hey, you can't make any of these arguments now because you didn't make them earlier, even though you didn't have a lawyer and we didn't allow you to have time to get a lawyer. So there's also this possibility that the appeals court can basically waive all of our arguments and say that the issue is settled, and then we basically have no way to appeal, which is interesting because if it turns out that that's what happens, it basically means that the government can come in and expedite any legal proceeding to the point that a small business wouldn't have an opportunity to retain counsel and not have the opportunity to appeal the decision, something about the Sixth Amendment and a full and fair hearing. You know, what's interesting to also note about this entire process is that as an interested third party, I basically had no rights. I had no right to counsel. I had no right to a full and fair hearing. I had no right to a hearing in my own locality. You know, I was based in Texas. I happened to know lawyers in Texas. It's kind of by chance that I found one that I could work with in Alexandria. So it's kind of where things are at. The legal team's also fighting a few other issues that I don't think I can talk about. But the big one is, of course, the SSL keys.
Did you already have a hand over?
Yeah. It was $5,000 a day if I didn't. So I shut down the service, and I started dumping all of the data to a set of encrypted external drives, which are now at an undisclosed location. And drove over to the FBI field office in Dallas the next morning and turned over the keys. I actually left the service shut down for about 24 hours before I posted the letter on my website, and that was to give time for that copy process to at least progress to the point where most of the user information had been moved off to external encrypted drives, because most of my users didn't have the benefit of the secure storage feature. They haven't asked a question yet.
I was curious if the issue of warrant canaries ever came up throughout your legal hearings and what the result was.
Thought about warrant canaries a lot lately. I think I'll refer you to my Reddit AMA for the answer, but basically the only way that they would even be remotely effective is if you did them by hand every day. The problem with that is, and you'd have to also sign them using something like GPG, and you'd have to keep that GPG key secret and secure, which means probably keeping it offline in an air-gapped computer, which would, of course, again, be a big pain. You'd almost need a full-time employee whose sole job it was to every morning when they came in, post a canary report. Because the government can order you to not do something. They can't necessarily order you to do something. So if it's an automated process, they can simply order you not to interrupt it. Of course, it's another one of these things where you have to hope that somebody who's using a canary happens to end up in a situation like I am, where they're facing the full weight and pressure of the federal government and their willingness to kind of go beyond what the law says, which is what happened in my case, and hope that, you know, they had a canary set up before we'll ever find out if it's going to be an effective tool.
What do you think average citizens can do in the short term and the long term to address these issues?
That's a good question, because I'm not a politician, so I don't have a good answer. But I can tell you that I'm fighting on the legal front. I know I'm fighting as much as I can on the technological front. I think we spent the last 40 years trying to make things work, and we're going to spend the next 40 years trying to make things work securely. But on the political front, that's a little trickier, because as individuals, it's hard to get the attention of Congress. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And I guess that's the only thing I can ultimately recommend, is that we need to bring more attention to bear on this issue, because at least to date, Congress has completely ignored it. Now, they've had a few good excuses. There was the chemical weapons attack in Syria, and of course, there was the debt crisis. You know, it doesn't really matter what the rules on privacy are if you don't have a federal government around anymore. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of the situation we face. And I spoke to Rand Paul a few weeks ago. He has some other thoughts on that that involve using FOIA and the Privacy Act, and we're looking into those as well. But, you know, it's hard to make Congress do anything. And that's unfortunate, but I think we each individually, if you feel like I do, can reach out and try and influence your individual member of Congress.
What do you think is the... Unfortunately, I have to call a timeout, interrupt, because we're supposed to be out of this room at 5:30.
But so I want to stop, and hopefully later
really?
I can,
somebody coming in here afterwards?
can ask some questions out in the lobby. But
yeah, no,
I think we should first thank him for...
Flight is in the